lands have increased in number and might. You feel that you have been able to, you know, take your army to another corner of the world, and you have been able to engulf another piece of land with your authority. And that makes you happy. And you think that that is what Islam is. And that is the progress of the Muslim land and the Muslim society. Or, O Muslim leader, you are pleased that the Muslim society is acting upon the apparent acts of worship of Islam, the apparent orders like the prayers, the tax, the khums, the zakat. And you feel that, the Muslim society is progressing and it is doing a good job. But, O Muslim leader, O Muslim governor, O general, O army general, O people, that is not it. That is not what Islam wants. Because I, as Ali, alayhi salam, am telling you that you people are facing the same sickness that you faced when the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam came to you.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to IRIB English Radio. Now, it is a kind of a dilemma in our minds that is it possible that a Muslim society is observing all the apparent necessities of Islam, you know, and yet be in the very starting point that they were in when the Prophet came? Like, are they back to square one, despite the fact that they are doing all of these apparent glamorous and maybe, you know, extravagant acts of worship and acts of apparent devotion? Is that enough? Imam Ali alayhi salam saying, no, you are back to square one, O people. You have returned back to that area, to that particular position that you are in. What was there at the time of the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam? What was the problem with the community? What was the sickness at that time when he just came? There were some rebellious and tyrannical people who were controlling others and not allowing them to progress. There were dictatorial rulers. There was a vast gap between the rich and the poor. Some were being enslaved while others were enjoying riches that could not be imagined. People were in ignorance, compound ignorance. That means they didn't even know that they don't know. People were stuck in difficulties and problems. Yet at that time, the people were not aware. They did not know that they are sick. They did not know that they have problems. In fact, they thought that they are progressing. That very problem today, O Muslims, you have. Imam Ali alayhi salam is saying that if that time you had tyrannical rulers, today also you have tyrannical rulers. If at that time there was ignorance, today also we see the same ignorance. Why not when today a Jew, one of the bad Jews, no, of course there's good Jews and bad Jews, one of the bad Jews has become one of your scholars and he's judging and deciding between you. What has happened to your community? Ka'ab al-Ahbar, which is a famous scholar at the time. That means it shows that you have gone back to that ignorant state. And that is the danger that we are facing. And that is what we need to avoid. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
قال النبي محمد من كنت مولاه هذا علي سيد فاز من ولاه هو بالكتاب مسدد والنور معنا باب العلوم ومرشد هو آيات الله من ناداه أو لبه حين دعاه نال مناه هو في الشدائد منجد والفضل يمناه هو في المحاسن أحمد والوحي رباه.
Cultural news. Social news. Scientific news. Artistic news. With delight.
Colombia's long hunt for a fabled Spanish ship, San Jose Galleon, that sank centuries ago, comes to an end. But the mission leads to two more nearby shipwrecks filled with treasures.
We have found two additional ships, one ship that is from the colonial period and another that, from the point of view of preliminary analysis, corresponds to the Republican period of our history. We also have related vessels, around a dozen similar boats, that will be located by our Navy.
The colonial-era vessels were found near Colombia's Caribbean port of Cartagena. A remotely operated vehicle reached 900 meters beneath to capture the shipwrecks and treasures inside them. San Jose Galleon sank in a deadly battle against English warships in 1708, taking with it billions in treasure. The Colombian president says the findings will be preserved and protected until extraction is done completely. The riches will then be displayed in museums.
Colombian scientists managed to reproduce an endangered species of frog, bringing it back from the brink of extinction. The scientists were able to reproduce 29 specimens of Lehman's poison frog after years of investigations and experiments using a lab built specifically for this species. They have released the frogs into the Colombian Pacific region with the hope of starting its repopulation.
We observe how the frogs adapt to this ecosystem, which is theirs, but it is a constant monitoring. And the idea is that of these first 29 frogs at the moment, there are many more little frogs, and now we can tell the world that they are not in danger of extinction.
The scientists, however, warn that this particular species of frog is very difficult to reproduce or maintain under human care. They are also worried about the illegal trade of the frogs, which has already played a key role in pushing the rare species towards extinction. Colombia is home to over 700 frog species, more than any other country in the world except Brazil. In Brazil, a 100-year-old man has broken the world record for the longest spell working at a single company. Walter Orthman has entered the Guinness World Record books for working at the same fabric company for an astonishing period of 84 years. He started on the factory floor before moving into administration and later on into the sales management. Despite his extraordinary accomplishment, Orthman's advice for those looking for a long and fulfilling professional life is surprisingly routine.
You have to like to work. I started to work with that willingness and fighting spirit. You also have to start working on something you like to do. You can't just do any job to say that you're working. That doesn't work. You're not going to be able to stand it. You have to look for a job that you like to do. And there, you won't even feel the time passing. That's what happened with me. I started working here, and I liked it. I worked my way up from point to point until I got to the position I'm in today.
Ortman says his secret to a long life and breaking the record is having a healthy lifestyle and staying away from junk food. He says he avoids sugar and salt as much as possible and tries to keep a diet that is healthy for the mind and soul. In order to stay sharp, Orthman says he does stretches and maintains physical activity. A bridge too scary for many, but just the right place for those with a head for heights. Vietnam has opened the world's longest glass bottom bridge to the public.
The now recorded longest glass-bottom cliffside pathway, and it's spectacular, the engineering required to build that into the side of a cliff. but maintain all the features of nature, the greenery, the rock. It's been an amazing project, very successful, and I think it will attract a lot of tourists.
The White Dragon Suspension Bridge fittingly opened with a dragon dance. The structure is longer than the previous record holder in China and has two sections. One stretches over 630 meters between two mountains, while the other runs around a cliffside. Visitors can look straight down at the valley 150 meters below. The structure is safe and made from three layers of 40 millimeter tempered glass. With soaring fuel prices, the importance of solar-powered vehicles is on the rise. Now a Kashmiri math teacher has gone viral for creating a car powered by solar energy. The car, which is fully covered with solar panels, uses sunlight to charge its battery. The vehicle also has a braking system that regenerates power to its batteries. The inventor of the car, Bilal Ahmed, says he has spent about $19,000 for his project and has not used external funds.
It was my dream to invent a solar car for the people of Kashmir. It took me 13 years to complete my dream. I'm thankful to the Almighty I succeeded in this project.
Bilal says he has built the car manually and without any automation. He hopes to put his fully automatic car into mass production to create jobs for local people.
Just like humans and animals, plants get sick too. But what do you do with an ill plant? An Indian man has found an answer to that. He has opened an emergency room only for plants in Amritsar, a city in India's Punjab state. A tax officer and his wife have set up the Pushpa Tree and Plant Hospital. In Pushpa, they have expert biologists and tree lovers on hand to provide the so-called sick patients with their essential nutrients. The clinic aims to treat any and every disease and even has an emergency vehicle on call for unhealthy trees around the city. The officer's wife says, just as we humans bleed, breathe, and need cures, plants also bleed, breathe, and need cures.
We provide approximately 32 various services for plants and trees, like if there's a nail in the tree, how to take out that nail, deep poisoning of the trees. Yes, you heard it right. There are people who poison the trees. Again, if the tree is not bearing fruits, there's an attack of mealybugs or another insects. That's also cured here. If the trees or plants are dying and you're unable to take care of them, even that problem is sorted out.
Only a month into the hospital's operation, Rohit Mehra and his team of 20 volunteers have already received more than 300 queries. The hospital is also completely free of charge.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Staff at the National Zoo of Cuba in the capital city of Havana are celebrating a new arrival of a rare baby white rhinoceros. The little calf, named Al, quickly became popular among other animals in the park after he was born. He is part of a conservation program that will add to a gene bank for future breeding. Al is the second white rhinoceros to be born in captivity in 18 years. The park is home to 8 white rhinos and 4 black ones. Zoo staff say the park has one of the largest exhibits of this mammal among zoos in Latin America. White rhinos are endangered species and their population has dwindled due to illegal poaching and environmental destruction.
Persian fallow deer is a unique but endangered species known for its sleek and spotted body. In this report, our correspondent Youssef Jalali takes us on a quick tour around one of the world's few protected shelters of Persian fallow deer in Iran's city of Sari.
We had to keep quiet and avoid making any sounds to film them, as they are shy and swift, and the slightest sound could send them sprinting and jumping away. Over 60 Persian fallow deer roam in Dashtanaz Wildlife Refuge in Iran's northern city of Sari. The endangered species is carefully protected here to be safe from predators and poachers.
The Persian fallow deer is native to Iran's Khuzestan province, but due to loss of habitat and threats posed to them by predators such as jackals and wild cats, they are endangered and need to be protected in semi-natural refuges like this one.
Persian fallow deer are mainly indigenous to open woodland areas spanning from East Mediterranean coasts to West and Southwest Iran. By 1875, they had gone extinct in all of their main habitats, except in southwest Iran. After a captive breeding program, the population has rebounded from only a handful of deer in the 1960s to over 200 individuals in Iran.
Dashtanaz Wildlife Refuge is 55 hectares wide. It was introduced in 1962 as a shelter for the Persian fallow deer when the species was on the brink of extinction. At that time, 5 deer were captured and translocated to this refuge. Over the past 6 decades, their number have been multiplied through captive breeding.
The Persian fallow deer is a rare ruminant mammal belonging to the family Cervidae. They're physically larger than other fallow deer, and their antlers are bigger and less palmate. Their special beauty has turned this sanctuary into a hot tourist attraction in Iran's north.
This sanctuary is a tourist destination for visitors who would like to see the Hyrkanian forests in Iran's north and at the same time enjoy the wildlife and learn about efforts made to save the Persian fallow deer from extinction.
In 2015, the Persian fallow deer was registered in the IUCN Red List of Threatened Species. Dashtanaz authorities hope through continued captive breeding, the population of these special creatures will soon reach the desired number, and hopefully they will be reintroduced to their natural habitat in southwest Iran.
While they live far from their original habitat, these alluring creatures feel at home here, where they will be safe from the dangers lurking outside, which may lead to their extinction. So here, Persian fallow deer continue to embellish the nature and charm visitors with their beauty. Youssef Jalali from Dashtanaz Wildlife Refuge in Sari.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away, proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. We are going to talk about the rules of Hajj. in fact, according to Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography. A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching Makassas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up till 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching, one can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that. Back to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad Hossein's program, and Sheikh Javid, as always, our guest speaker in the studio. Okay, Sheikh Javid, you know, we are talking about some of the jurisprudential rules for Hajj and according to Ayatollah Khamenei. Let's talk about some of the general rules for Hajj Tamattu. Would you shed some light on this issue?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In order for the for Hajj al-Tamattu to be valid, there are certain conditions to be fulfilled. First of all, intention is a requirement. It is necessary for the individual to form his intention. Obviously, every act of worship that is done must be coupled with intention. No act of worship is valid without pure and sincere intention. Therefore, the person who intends to perform Hajj al-Tamattu must make his niyyah that he will perform the Hajj in compliance with God's order and in obedience to his commandment. Right. So this is the first requirement. And yes, of course, intention must begin from the time of wearing ihram, because ihram is the first act of Hajj. Every individual who wants to perform Hajj, any kind of Hajj, whether it is Hajj Umrah or Hajj Tamattu, must begin with or by wearing
the ihram for Hajj, okay?
Yes.
And of course, when you perform Hajj Tamattu, you begin wearing the ihram from the station, from Miqat, and you start performing the Umrah of Tamattu. Mm-hmm. For a person who goes from remote areas,
yes,
not from course.
from the vicinity of
Mecca, because they are not supposed to perform Hajj Tamattu.
Right.
So it is necessary that one intend to perform Hajj Tamattu, otherwise his Hajj will not be in order.
Yes, of course, and no action or no ritual is accepted without this proper intention, right,
as you said. There's no amal done without niyyah. There is a hadith, in fact, related to the same thing.
Yes,
now, then there is another condition, if I have time to continue with the rules,
yes,
the general
of
rules.
Course.
Of course, both Umrah and Hajj need to be performed in the months of Zilhajjah, okay?
Right.
The months of Zilhajjah. And mm-hmm. Zilhajjah is the month in which Umrah and Hajj Tamattu should be performed. No one can delay it or can do it before or after this month, the month of Zilhajjah. The Haji or the pilgrim must prepare himself to arrive in Mecca within the prescribed time, mm-hmm. within the time, mm-hmm. so that he may be able to perform Hajj within the prescribed time. You know,
I see.
So of course he has to. Many pilgrims, because we have pilgrims who arrive in Medina first of all, and then they go to Mecca. And then we have pilgrims who go straight to Mecca without going to Medina, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So there are two groups of
right.
pilgrims. Some go straight to Medina, they perform ziyarah of the holy tomb of the Prophet, peace be upon him and his family, and they stay there for a few days, and then they set out and leave for Mecca. They go to Masjid Shajara, for example. They mm-hmm. perform, they wear the ihram, they do the talbiyah and make niyyah, and then move on towards Kaaba.
So is it necessary to go to Medina?
No, it's not necessary, you know.
Not even before Mecca or after one?
It is not necessary. But, you know, it is very important to visit the holy
mosque,
Masjid al-Nabi, and the tomb of the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him,
right.
and his family, and also the Baqiyah cemetery, okay,
mm-hmm.
where the four imams or the Shia imams are buried.
Yes, of
so,
course.
So of course, it is a very a spiritual journey, and it is highly recommended.
Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh. Let's take a short break and we'll be back and continue our program, Islamic Laws. Don't go away.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. Sheikh Javid, you were talking about some of the general rules for Hajj Tamattu. Are there any more?
Sure. I want to say that one of the general rules for Hajj Tamattu is that the Umrah and Hajj need to be performed in the same year. In mm-hmm. the same year. And of course, there's also another condition. Umrah and Hajj should be performed for one and the same person, okay? If you are performing Hajj, you should do it for yourself, not on behalf of another person. And if you want to perform it on behalf, if you are actually a proxy doing mm-hmm. performing Hajj on behalf of another person, you should perform it on behalf of one person only. You cannot do it on behalf of too many people. You cannot consider or take too many people into your consideration and perform Hajj on their behalf. So Hajj is indivisible in the sense that it cannot be performed on behalf of different people.
So a group, the intention for doing the Hajj for a group is not possible.
Yes, and of course it implies that the person who is performing Hajj on behalf of, for example, of a dead person, needs to perform both Umrah and Hajj himself.
Mm-hmm.
So if you are appointed as a proxy or a representative performing right. Hajj on behalf of a deceased person, like you're, for example, someone's has died, maybe he is your grandfather, and you perform Hajj on his behalf, you should perform it both Umrah and Hajj on his behalf. And then it's not permissible to separate between Umrah and Hajj. These are some general rules. Okay,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
There are many conditions associated with both Hajj and Umrah. Of course, these conditions have been explained in the rituals or in the books, Hajj Manasik al Hajj or the Hajj rituals, authored by His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei. And of course, for those people who wish to read and understand the details regarding Hajj rituals, I want them and I request them to read the Hajj book, mm-hmm. Hajj rituals,
yes.
for themselves in order to understand fully. Let's also not forget that many Shia Muslims who live in foreign countries, who live in a Sunni setting and a Sunni environment, are very much under the impression of the Sunni countries and mm-hmm. Sunni propagation.
Yes,
and one should always keep himself abreast with the rulings and fatwa,
yes, exactly.
of the religious authorities, so as not to make a mistake. Because if you make a mistake and you get back home, you will regret. Okay,
mm-hmm.
not learning. About Hajj rituals and not understanding or asking someone, because there are many scholars,
mm-hmm.
there are many ulama who accompany these Hajj caravans or Hajj groups, and these are scholars who are ready every second and who are ready to answer questions. So
yes.
if a person entertains doubt about any act of Hajj, he should not hesitate to ask the alim or any alim that
exactly.
is there to answer his or her question.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javed, for your nice piece of advice to be, in fact, conscious of the rulings of our own sect. Thank you very much for listening to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio from me and the rest of the crew. Until then, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
رحمن رحيم منان كريم سلام عليم من جاء إلى
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Sheikh Baqir Sharif Al-Qarashi decides to compile.
So we can consider Sayyid Hadi Khosro Shahi.
Shahid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr. He was born in Kadhimiya.
The first and the most important thing that we can learn from Allama Tabatabai is his great effort.
In this regard, I should like to say that one of the great benefits of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmud Shahrudi was.
When we look at the works of late Rawzati,
there is a famous sentence from Mirza Khalil Qamarai that he says in Farsi, "Tuhid kalame baraye kalame tuhid."
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in the teacher.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page. This is the teacher and analysis on the thoughts and works of the most outstanding Muslim Shiite scholars. I'm Atta, the host of this program. Within the studio for today's discussion are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Mahdavi and Sheikh Ziyani. Sheikh Mahdavi, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
And Sheikh Ziyani, assalamu alaikum to you.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
The personality or the outstanding scholar with whom we are mainly concerned for today's discussion is no one but Abdul Karim Hayri Yazdi, mainly known as Ayatollah Muassis, because he is believed to be the founder of the Islamic House of the Holy City of Qom. Before getting to his scholarly life and his, we can say, achievements, let's be a little bit concerned with his early life. Sheikh Mahdavi, let's start with you, brother. What information can you give us about his early life?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Ayatollah Sheikh Abdul Karim Ha'iri Yazdi, as his name is speaking, he was born in one of the villages of Yazd, Ardakan, and after the demise of his father, he moved to Yazd with his mother, started learning Islamic studies, and after a while he moved to Iraq again with his mother. Mm-hmm. In Iraq, he started learning all Islamic studies under the teaching of the grand scholars of Iraq. For a while he stayed in Najaf, and then he moved to Samarra, benefited from the grand asatid, namely Mirza Shirazi, the grand Mirza, actually the one who issued the ban of tobacco or tobacco.
Yes.
Also, he benefited from Sheikh Fazlullah Nuri, Sayyid Muhammad Fisharaki Isfahani, and most of the Mirza Hussein Nuri. He got permission of Rivaya from Mirza Hussein Nuri, and also he got permission of Ijtihad from the grand ulama. When we look at his move, we see that for several times he went from Yazd to Iraq. He stayed in Karbala for a while, and then he went to Najaf. From Najaf, he moved to Samarra. And he went back to Iraq, wanted to start one very good seminary school in Iraq. But since he didn't have a good supplier, and he felt that this situation is not good enough to yes. initiate or establish a seminary school, he left Iraq again back to the Iraq. Stayed there, and after the demise of Mirza Shirazi, he went back to Iran, and he didn't go back again to Iraq anymore. Mm-hmm. And it is said that in one of his trip, when he was coming back from the ziyarah of Imam Reza, on his trip, on his way, he stayed in Qom because of the invitation that he had received from the ulama of Qom, that if possible to stay in Qom and organize the Hawza of Qom. So he stayed in Qom with a group of his great students, namely Imam Khomeini, Rahmatullah Alayh, Sayyid Ahmad Khunsari, Sayyid Muhammad Taghi Khunsari. All of these great ulama were his student at that time that decided to stay with him. Mm-hmm. In Qom, in order to establish and found this great seminary school of Qom that nowadays every Shia community here and there is benefiting from the scholars and leaders who has been studied in this school.
That's all right. Sheikh Ziyani, before this establishment of Ayatollah Hayri Yazdi, we did not have any Hawza in the city of Qom or something like that? Or no, he was a kind of reviver, I mean, of this legacy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. You know that Qom, from the beginning of its establishment, was a city that was famous by the name of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salatu wa salam. And even about 1,000 years ago, even more than that, at the time of Imam al-Hadi alayhi salatu wasalam, Imam al-Hasan al-Askari alayhi salatu wasalam, we had companions of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salatu wasalam living in the city of Qom. So that the city of Qom is accompanied with the name of Islamic Seminary during the history. But this name, I mean, the Islamic Seminary of Qom has been facing with some, we may say, uprisings and, you know, downs.
Ups and downs, yes.
Yeah, with some ups and downs during its history.
Yes.
And when the Hawza in Najaf al-Ashraf was established by Sheikh Tusi rahmatullah alayh, after that, most of Islamic seminaries went under the shadow of Najaf. Of course, we had famous houses in Hille, in a famous city in Iraq, yes. Also in Isfahan, also somehow in Nishabur, but it was a Sunni school of thought. In Qom also, and we may have...
In Jabal Amal in Lebanon.
Amal in Lebanon.
Right. Yes.
And in the... we had different cities, but Najaf al-Ashraf was the dominant Hawza at that time for a long period of time. And even Sheikh Abdul Karim Hawari Yazdi himself, he studied in Najaf al-Ashraf. But after that, when he moved to Iraq, and you know, when he went to Iraq, there was a seminary over there. Yes. He wanted to promote that Hawza. So also it is important to know that he came back to Iraq. He decided to promote the Hawza of Hawzatul Ilmiya in Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
And after the demise of Sayyid Muhammad Kazim Yazdi, the grand marja of Shia school of thought, Mirza Muhammad Taghi Shirazi wrote a letter to Ayatollah Sheikh Abdul Karim Hariri and asked him to return back to Atawatul Aliyat, I mean to Najaf al-Ashraf or Karbala, to be ready for taking the position of Marja'iyah of Shia, because he was at disposal of this, you know, position. But Ayatollah Sheikh Abdul Karim Hariri refused and said that, in response to that letter, he said that my responsibility nowadays is to stay in Iran, because Iran is in danger of corruption, mm-hmm. and is in danger of getting deteriorated from the way of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salatu wasalam. So it shows the broad horizon of thought of Ayatollah Sheikh Abdul Karim Hawari, that at that time even he had this mindset that I should promote the religion in the country of Iran. And when he was invited to Qom, there was a seminary over there, because yes. there were some scholars also living.
Okay.
But this seminary was not a famous one, was not a powerful one, was not a seminary in which great scholars, you know, coming and going. No, Qom was at that time famous because of the name of Hazrat Fatima al-Masuma, salamullah alayha, and the scholars used to come to this city to stay for a while to have a ziyarat and then go to Mashhad and then come back again to Qom for ziyarat and then go to Iraq. You know, we didn't have, you know, prominent resident scholars that we may count them as great figures at that time. So Sheikh Abdul Karim Hariri came to Qom, and this story is also very important to know, that when he was invited by scholars in Qom to migrate to this city and to handle and rule over the Islamic Seminary of Qom,
especially Ayatollah Bafqi.
Yes,
that's right.
Because you know Sheikh Muhammad Taghi Bafqi also was in Najaf, and then he himself came back to Qom, and he was amongst the inviters of Sheikh Abdul Karim Hariri to Qom.
Okay.
In response to this invitation, Sheikh Abdul Karim Hariri came to Qom and went to the shrine of Lady Fatima al-Masuma salamullah alayha and paid a visit and ziyara to this shrine, and then he made istikhara. And you know that Sheikh Abdul Karim Hariri was not a person of istikhara. He was not, because some scholars, they may do istikhara more, but Sheikh Abdul Karim Hariri was not believing in doing istikhara in many occasions. But at that time, because he was feeling that this occasion and this event is very important, he made istikhara. And this verse was the result of his istikhara, that A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim, wa'atuni bi ahlikum ajma'in. And Sheikh understood that Hazrat Fatima al-Masuma salamun alayha has invited him to come to Qom and to take the position of the manager of the Hawzatul Ilmiya of Qom.
And I think this was the most difficult task for his whole life.
Yeah,
but it really was a nice achievement, and he we can say left
a rich legacy up to today's world. The holy city of Qom, beside Mashhad and Najaf and Karbala, has one of the most outstanding Islamic houses. And then I think because of his great status among the ulama, many scholars accept his invitation, okay? And the teaching courses starts in the holy city of Qom, in the, I mean, official way and in the formal way, isn't it, Sheikh Matawi?
Yeah, you're right. And something that we have to mention, that when we are talking about founding the Hawza Elmiya of Qom, it doesn't mean necessarily that you have to construct a big building and call them that this is the Hawza of Qom. No, by that time we had this phase here, that is the center of the all small seminary schools of Qom, or all small Hawza, are related to Faiziyya.
Okay.
But Faiziyya has been built during the time of Safavid.
Yes.
So it means almost four centuries ago. Okay. But when you are talking about Sheikh Abdul Karim Ha'iri Arzi, it's almost about one century ago. Almost at the beginning of the this century. I mean 1300s.
Okay.
So what do we mean exactly by founding the Hawza? It means that to organize the system of teaching.
Or to manage.
I mean, yes.
That's right.
To start having a board of teachers, to organize the textbooks. I mean, the syllabus, different levels from which students have to start. For example, after the first level, they go for the second and the third. Through all these process, which is nicely organized, they know how to start, how to end, where to go, the system of discussion, or what we call it as a mubahatha, to give order to this system. Okay. So this is the true meaning of founding Hawza al-Ilmiya al-Qom, because by that time, as my brother mentioned, we had many scholars residing in Qom, and also at the same time we had students who would benefit from those scholars, but not having a comprehensive system which would cover all of these system under which. So by founder we exactly mean this. And this is also mentioned in his biography, that he was really caring of the students.
Okay.
And he had this intention to do it on his own to the moment that it was possible. And it is also mentioned that once he was reported that one of the tulab is not feeling well. So that moment, maybe it was one of the exceptions that he was free and he wanted to benefit from this very spiritual action. So he even did not accept the servants or those people who are placed for this work to do it. He said, okay, let me, as a manager of the Hawza, go and provide the medicine and take it to that talaba on my own. So it shows that how he was down to earth manager, not to just sticking to the chair and not going and welcoming the talabe, having a nice and very good relationship with the students. He was not that of the actually managers.
You know, in his mindset, I mean managerial mindset, even teaching the foreign languages was among one of his achievements. As we could see, we can say in the life of Ayatollah Hujjat Kuh Kamerayi, we said that he was one of the deputies of Ayatollah Ali Yazdi, and his school, Amin Hujjatiya School, now it is famous for welcoming the foreign schools, but this is not something new. It had roots, you know, in the life and in the style of the management of the late Ayatollah Abdul Karim Ha'iri Yazdi. That's all right. Okay, anything, Ms. Sheikh Zainal?
Another important point regarding him is that he was really in love of Ahlul Bayt, alayhi wasalam, so that he was the reciter of Rawda of Ahlul Bayt, alayhi wasalam, when he was young. And he was eager to run Majlis al-Rawda for Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam, instead of, you know, some, you know, passion plays that is in Farsi, it's named Ta'ziyah.
Yes.
And he didn't like the manner of Ta'ziyah, so that he was preferring the Majlis al-Rawda, and he himself also was involved in reciting Rawda.
That's right.
Another important point of him is the books that he compiled and was the author of them. The most important, which is the Durarul Fawa'id, that also named as Durarul Usul, that is a Usuli book of him, that is the course in which he was he was delivering in his Usuli course in Kharij level of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
That's right.
And the students of him,
yes,
there are really important figures like Muhammad Ali Araki, Sayyid Muhammad Reza Golpaygani, Mirza Mahmud Ashtiani, and many others, Imam Khomeini, yes, Rahmatullah Alayhi, these great, you know, scholars of the galaxy of Shia school of thought in contemporary age are all the students of late Ayatollah Sheikh Abdul Karim Hariri Rahmatullah Alayhi.
Really a true source of benefit for the Islamic studies, which is even nowadays active, you know, and these new generations are really indebted to the achievements and the efforts of the people like Abdul Karim Hariri, as the may Allah bless his soul. About his demise, it is documented that it was Ziqada 17th, you know, in the year 1355, according to the lunar Hijri calendar. After 15 years of residence in the city of Qom, he passed away. Ayatollah Sayyid Sadiq Qumi did the burial prayer, and he was buried in the holy shrine of Lady Fatimatul Masima in vicinity of the tomb of Lady Fatimatul Masima, which is nowadays the burial places for so many of the great ulama and maraja, with the high, we can say, marble stone, we can say, grave stones over there, really the visiting place, and so many people pay homage and visit to these tombs nowadays too, in the holy shrine of Lady Fatimatul Masuma in the city of Qom. Thank you much, Sheikh Ziania and Sheikh Mahdavi, for your nice elaboration regarding the life of Sheikh Abdul Karim Hariri Yazdi, mainly known as Ayatollah Muassis, the founder or the establisher of the Islamic Hausa of the holy city of Qom. May Allah bless his soul. Thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to us. For more information on this program and to download for free our previous programs, I mean The Teacher, visit our website at parstoday.com/en/Call of Islam page, also our YouTube channel, Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. Till another episode, God bless you all. Fi aman Allah.
Ukraine and Western governments.
Part 2.
There is absolutely no doubt that snipers are working here. I've counted 10 bodies.
Now on the brink of a civil war, at least 70 dead so far, and the death toll rising.
What we saw here today was a revolution.
We've invested over $5 billion to assist Ukraine in these and other goals.
NATO has expanded into 13 countries, up to the borders of Russia. 13 countries.
The focus has to be on not allowing this crisis to turn into hot war between Ukraine and Russia.
Ukraine. It's an ancient and proud land with a rich history filled with much beauty, heroism, and sacrifice. Ukraine is a borderland, a place where east meets west. This is the flag of Ukraine. The blue represents the sky. The gold, its seemingly endless fields of wheat. Ukraine is a prize many have sought, and much blood has spilled in the quest to possess it. Ukraine has been the pathway for Western powers as they attempted to conquer the East. Another historical document that changed the fate of Ukraine was the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact of 1939, one of many such agreements being signed between European countries and rising Germany. Attempting to protect his nation from the approaching Nazi threat, Joseph Stalin negotiated a treaty of non-aggression with Adolf Hitler. While promising each other peace, the Soviet and German foreign ministers Molotov and Ribbentrop realigned the map of Eastern Europe, splitting it into German and Soviet spheres of influence. In January 1943, USSR troops started pushing the Nazis back, liberating one part of Ukraine after another. Western Ukraine was the last Ukrainian region held by the Germans, finally being liberated in October of 1944. The era of political and military tension between the U.S. and the USSR lasted for nearly 45 years, keeping humanity under the constant threat of nuclear war. In this battle, the United States never lost sight of Ukraine's importance. U.S. intelligence kept a close eye on Ukrainian nationalist organizations as a possible source of counterintelligence against the Soviet Union. CIA documents that just recently have been declassified show strong ties between U.S. intelligence and Ukrainian nationalists since 1946. From the CIA agency report, it is clear that they were not mistaken about the nature of Ukrainian nationalist organizations or their leader, Stepan Bandera himself. By 1954, the agency excused the illegal activities of the OUN security branch in the name of Cold War necessity. In 1949, Mykola Lebed, the man responsible for the massacres in Volhynia, was moved to the United States, where he died in 1989 without ever being investigated or pursued as a war criminal. The CIA moved to protect Ukrainian nationalist leader Mykola Lebed from criminal investigation by the Immigration and Naturalization Service in 1952. The Cold War would heat up and cool down by turns, while both rivals were obsessively building up military capacity. The turning point took place when the new era, Perestroika, came to the USSR with its new leader, Mikhail Gorbachev, in the middle of the 1980s. Perestroika meant restructuring towards liberalization and democratization. It certainly had a positive impact on the international situation.
Astonishing news from East Germany, where the East German authorities have said, in essence, that the Berlin Wall doesn't mean anything anymore.
But inside the USSR, the weakening of Kremlin control had different consequences. The people's growing discontent made Ukraine more vulnerable to outside forces, and a new kind of warfare was launched, one not known before, the color revolutions.
Violent clashes erupted in the Ukrainian capital Kiev as more than 100,000 people protested against a government decision to delay an association deal with the EU.
Arseniy Yatsenyuk, leader of the opposition party, Fatherland. Oleg Tagnibok, leader of the opposition nationalist far-right political party, Svoboda. Vitali Klitschko, leader of the opposition party, UDAR. Robert Perry is a longtime investigative journalist based in Washington, D.C., best known for his major disclosures about the Iran-Contra scandal in the 1980s. He is the founder of Consortium News, where he has reported extensively on the crisis in Ukraine and the forces behind the unrest.
An NGO is a non-governmental organization. Now, many NGOs are quite legitimate. They represent good causes. Maybe they help people in a country feed or deal with water problems or deal with various kinds of social problems. But there are some NGOs that have become funded by government entities and serve more the purpose of that government rather than trying to serve the people that they are ostensibly working for. One thing we saw in the 1980s, at that point the Central Intelligence Agency had been largely discredited because of scandals that had been exposed in the 1970s.
For 15 years, the CIA has secretly financed overseas activities of the National Students Association. But then there came to light a fantastic web of CIA penetrations.
So when the Reagan administration came in, there was this concept that instead of having the CIA, which traditionally would go into these different target countries, funding their media, funding NGOs, funding different political operations, that was essentially farmed out to a new organization called the National Endowment for Democracy, which was created in 1983. And it would do pretty much what the agency used to do. It would go into one of these countries and it would support various political groups, train activists, deal with journalists, business groups, and try to advance U.S. foreign policy interests, sometimes against the interests of the host government, the target government. And beyond that, they received financial and other logistical help from the National Endowment for Democracy and other U.S. agencies that helped them training activists, working with journalists to get their side